Miles Davis's Bitches Brew is one of the most iconic albums in American music. Fans have been fortunate in the past few years to gain access to Davis's live recordings from this time when he was working with an ensemble that has come to be known as the Lost Quintet. In his new book, The Miles Davis Lost Quintet and Other Revolutionary Ensembles, jazz historian and musician Bob Gluck explores the performances of this revolutionary group, Davis's first electric band, to illuminate the thinking of one of our rarest geniuses and, by extension, the transition in American music that he and his fellow players helped usher in. Bob Gluck, again, is the author of The Miles Davis Lost Quintet and Other Revolutionary Ensembles, and it is a pleasure to welcome Bob Gluck to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. When did you start thinking that this would be a good idea to delve into this part of the Miles Davis story?
Well, the first time that I found myself interested in this music in particular was way before I ever thought of writing a book about it. I had taken many years away from playing the piano. And when I started again, it was like 20 years not playing the piano. When I started again in 2005, one of the first things I did was go to the repertoire from this recording. So I guess I've been thinking about it for just about a decade.
And what did you want to learn? What did you want to know? I assume there were baseline questions that you wanted to answer.
Well, this is the second book that I've written, and I was really delighted to be able to return to your show again after talking about my book maybe 3 years ago about Herbie Hancock's M1DC band. And in part, it's the same question that's really been on my mind for a while, and it's this. And it's not so much about great musical geniuses. It's more of what happens when a musician operates on the principle that you can hire a group of musicians to be part of your band, not tell them what to play, not tell them how to play, put them in a room, put them on stages. And what happens when they play together night after night without conventional rules kind of reining in what they might do? How does that unfold between people? In a way, it's really like I have a background in social work. So it's about what happens between people in groups. That's what strikes me so much about this band as it did the Herbie Hancock band.
Give us a timeline. How does this fit into the Miles Davis timeline?
Well, Miles Davis's second great quintet forms in 1962-63. And around 1965, and it was an acoustic band, around 1965, their music changes. It becomes more under the influence of Ornette Coleman and people who are loosening up the more traditional structures that govern how to play, moving away from song forms, from cyclical chord changes into more freer kinds of domains. And so Miles's acoustic band of the 60s starts making that shift, 65, 66. And around 1968, the band comes to an end, starts replacing musicians. And that happens at the end of 1968. The fully reconceived band goes on the road in fall 1969. And comes to its conclusion in the summer of 1970.
What was the, on Miles Davis's part, what was the conscious decision? What was he trying to achieve with this?
Well, Miles Davis is probably one of the hardest people to try to get inside his head. Then again, I'm not convinced you can get inside of anybody's head really fully. What do we know about Miles Davis during that period? Certainly, he was really interested in popular culture. He was interested in young black people. He was interested in sort of moving, finding a way to keep continuity with his past, which comes out of bebop and its complexity. And continue this improvised music in a jazz setting that somehow is open to many, many aspects of popular music, from from R&B, from funk in particular. He was fascinated by Jimi Hendrix. He was fascinated by James Brown, Sly and the Family Stone. But that's only half of it. And that story's been told by numerous people. The story that I'm trying to tell is that only tells part of it. The other part, and it goes back to the band I was the acoustic band I was describing from the 1960s, where they're beginning to loosen up their attachment to song forms, and beginning to operate on principles of intuition and functioning like a group mind. And that's really coming into the music, and that's given full rein in this new, much more electric band of the late 60s, early 70s.
And also a reaction to what else is happening in the music world, of course.
Absolutely. And in two directions that are in conflict. Now, mind you, Miles Davis was an important person on the roster of Columbia Records. And he sold a fair number of records. And he was being promoted as a crossover, quote-unquote, artist, opening up for largely white rock bands at the Fillmore East and the Fillmore West and moving away from jazz clubs. So that's part of it. And he's certainly responding to the late 60s rise in black consciousness. But he's also responding to an influence that he often kind of insisted he was resisting, and that was the impact of Ornette Coleman beginning in the late 50s, early 60s, which kind of leads to this whole idea of going off the script and thinking in terms of intuition and collective improvisation. And that's also very much in the air. So my book is trying to situate Miles not only in the electric and in the popular music world and the black music world, but also in the world that Ornette Coleman really sets loose and influences musicians across the country, and particularly in New York and Chicago.
There's really nothing boring about this man, is there?
No.
I assume, I mean, not that you look for that, but...
Well... It raises an interesting question, you know, because there's a new film coming out. It's out already. It's coming to the area this coming month, a biopic by Don Cheadle. And it reflects, you know, a fascination about Miles the person. And I'm interested in Miles the person. Sure, I'm a musician. Many of his band members are my senior colleagues. It's fascinating, but I'm much more interested in, you know, what happens within the bands. So I don't really have a need to get inside Miles's head,
right?
Through all of his fascinating aspects, and they were fascinating.
So, talk to us a little bit about that band, about the players who were with him, and how they make up the story.
Sure. Well, as coming out of the acoustic band, the figures that remain from the 60s acoustic band really are Miles Davis and Wayne Shorter, saxophonist extraordinaire, wonderful composer. Herbie Hancock leaves the acoustic band. He's moving on to his own stuff. Yeah. He's replaced soon by Chick Corea. Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock tell the same story about Miles and how they end up playing electric piano, which is basically they show up at either a club to play or a studio session, and they look and they say, "There's no piano here," and Miles Davis points to this electric instrument that they think's a toy and go, "Uh-oh." Hancock loves it. Chick Corea, not so keen on it. Bass player Dave Holland, Miles runs across playing at a major club in London, hires him. Jack DeJohnette then replaces Tony Williams on the drums. Jack DeJohnette, one of the members of the band who actually lives in our region.
Yes.
along with Dave Holland.
Sure, yeah, many times.
He's out of Chicago, and so he comes with a mixture of a background that includes rhythm and blues, but also the AECM, the Association for the Advancement of Creative Music, which was a very expansive composers collective that were really influenced heavily by Ornette Coleman. So that's the band. And later on, when Holland and Curia decide it's time for them to move on, Bitches Brew is released in April 1970. So Miles Davis knows they're going to go on tour, says, please stay for another few months. But they're already beginning to cook up what's going to be their next thing, which is an acoustic band called, which will eventually be called Circle.
Yeah.
So some of the dynamics come around that. So knowing that's going to happen, what Davis does is add another percussionist, Erta Morera, and add a second electric keyboardist, Keith Jarrett.
When you look at the, again, sort of the timeline, but ultimately the Miles Davis legacy, where do you think this particular chapter fits in?
Well, you notice that the book title is The Lost Quintet.
Right.
And, you know, how is it possible for somebody of the fame of Miles Davis to have lost something? You know, it's kind of a funny, odd idea. Lost in the sense that the public knows of that period through what Davis did in the studio. And his groundbreaking studio recording of the era was Bitches Brew, which included members of this touring band. But aside from those who had access to bootlegs over the years who actually heard the band tour, the broader public didn't really know about it. And so hence Lost, never made it, its own studio recording.
And with that, but obviously it's your contention that it shouldn't have been. It shouldn't have been lost.
Right. It shouldn't have been, because while it may well have been Miles Davis's own agenda to relate more to young Black America, which he did to a certain degree, and to be relating more to popular music, none of his recordings are dance albums. These were not dance bands. Even in his more Afrocentric bands, moving towards 1973, 74, 75, these are incredibly abstract, dense, beautiful, deafening, obtuse, just complex works. And this is the period of the Lost Quintet is where that complexity and experimentation really comes to its height. And that's why I think it's so important. In a way, it doesn't fit the easier timeline. Davis hears Hendrix, becomes friends with Hendrix, would have played together with him had Hendrix not died, is interested in funk, is interested in selling albums, wants to do well by Columbia, putting records, putting pressure on him. I'm suggesting there's really a different story, that Miles Davis was far more interesting than that and far more nuanced than that and ever experimenting. And like some other great musicians, what he did on the road, what he did in the studio wasn't the same thing. That, you know, never dull, never dull. And this band is so interesting for its wildness, unpredictability, and in a way, it's the Ornette Coleman democratic principle. It's like a civics lesson. Like, how are you all in it together on one hand, and at the same time, be fully yourselves? And so there are moments in these concerts, and we have concert recordings of them, where it's, you know, it could be pandemonium at one moment, and elegant and graceful and quiet and delicate at another moment, and ever shifting on its own terms collectively.
Bob Gluck is the author of the new book, The Miles Davis Lost Quintet, and Other Revolutionary Ensembles. Bob, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.